We have quite a piece of Exodus this morning before us, Exodus 15:22 through to 17:7, and we begin there on page 61. I think I've heard nothing but statements of the way in which God has blessed people through this series in Exodus, and I'm so thrilled because the Word of God is one thinks about it as one plans the preaching series as a team, and then we make decisions. It's marvelous to see it coming alive under the Spirit of God. And I hope again, as we continue this morning and as we go on with it, we intend now to go right through to the end of the book in May, June, and July as well, that all of us will learn more and more from the Lord who is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And in the passage we have before us this morning, we see this amazing interplay between the humanness of the people of God and the spirituality that believes God to be God. And that tension is in just about every Christian soul. The humanness that pulls us one way and the spiritual faith that wants to pull us the other way. Now, as I pondered this, there's one phrase that seems to me to sum up more than the title that we put on the sermon card. It's this: learning to trust and obey the Lord in every situation. Let me repeat it because you'll hear it again. Learning to trust and obey the Lord in every situation. Now, I want to apply that in five different ways this morning. Firstly, to put the underlining after the last three words: learning to trust and obey the Lord in every situation. Now, in chapter 14, you'll remember the amazing deliverance of God of his people out of bondage and across the Red Sea. We looked at that last time as Andrew expounded that to us. In chapter 15, which I think he didn't actually mention, that was part of his brief, but I'm glad he didn't because it gives me the chance to do so, there is a great praise session. And you'll know that there in chapter 15, as you look across it with your eye, they praise God for all that he has done. And see how it rings out: I will sing to the Lord. The Lord is my strength. This is my God. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name. Thy right hand, O Lord, glorious in power. Thy right hand, O Lord, shatters the enemy. Verse 11, who is like thee, O Lord, among the gods. And so down to verse 18, the Lord will reign forever and ever. And then through to 21, after all the dancing and timbrels and celebrations, sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. And you can imagine everybody going home from, not exactly church, but if you bring it up into present day, going home out of the doors, having had this massive praise session with all the instruments and everybody singing to the Lord, and everybody going out saying, marvelous. Tremendous time he had praising God tonight. And the sheer humanness in all of us is now shown in the contrast that comes immediately in verse 22. Then Moses led Israel onward from the Red Sea. They went into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days. That's after a Sunday, in our own terms, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, into the wilderness and found no water. And when they came to Marah, they couldn't drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. Therefore it was named Marah. And the people murmured against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? Now, this is the humanness that's in us all. How can you possibly have this massive praise session, having seen God do an amazing thing, bring this vast crowd of people out, deliver them from the hands of the Egyptians, pull back the waters of the Red Sea, and then as soon as you have something domestic, like no water to drink, you start murmuring again? And yet, aren't you like that? Perhaps you're not. I think it is something that's in all of us, that whatever God does, we are slow learners about the expectation for the next challenge that comes before us. And Exodus, I think, is honest. If we had been fabricating this story, if it had been an invention of man, we would never have put this down. human writing on the whole would add, and they lived happily ever after in the wilderness. But Exodus is honest. 3 days, bitter water, murmuring again, not looking to God, but grumbling. And one of the characteristics of the people of God in the first 5 books of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch, is their grumbling and their murmuring. It was the characteristic that was picked out in 1 Corinthians 10 that we had read earlier this morning as a warning to us. And they murmured instead of coming to God in every new situation. What was true of them was true of the disciples, of course, in the New Testament. There's that moment in Mark's Gospel in chapter 8 and verse 14. After the feeding of the 5,000, then after the feeding of the 4,000 as well, rubbing the lesson in, when they had forgotten to bring bread and only had one loaf in the boat. And you think that the disciples, having seen the Lord's ability to meet the need of 5,000 and then 4,000, would at least for the few of them in the boat have been able to apply it. But no, human nature is such that it finds it difficult to come at a fresh situation and still to believe God to be God. And Jesus has to take them through the lesson and says to them, slowly, how many baskets full of fragments were left over? And they answer him after the feeding of the 5,000. Then he says, and how many baskets full were left over after the feeding of the 4,000? And they tell him. Then he says to them, do you not yet understand? Aren't we like that? God works his miracle, he does his deliverance, he meets with us in blessing, and yet when we come at the next challenge to our faith, is he still God? In that situation? Obviously, it's a lesson we have to go on learning throughout our lives, and not least corporately as a church. When we had the first, in a sense, faith project that I was involved in Manchester, and the opening of our new hall, the young people wanted a place to meet. They had met in a cellar underneath a fish and chip shop, which was a good place to be in Manchester. However, it got flooded, and it was difficult to meet in there when there was 3 foot of water. And so they wanted somewhere else to meet, which they could make their own in their sort of particular style. Now, there was an immediate panic. And it was amazing how slowly we had to learn the very lesson of this passage, that the God who had already brought us through in a great project of faith was the same God over the young people wanting their cellar, as it were. And eventually, when they called themselves together and came to God together in prayer, God answered them in a way that they could never have believed possible, in providing them far more than they could have understood. And indeed, on the opening of the new building, it was the old school, the part that they had adapted into their own style of coffee bar and the style of those days was all dark and dim and all the rest of it. And when I showed some of the elderly people around, when we came into that bit, one of the elderly put out her hand and said, oh good, it stopped raining. It was so dark, she thought she was outside. But that was the style of the day, and they had the place just as they wanted it to be to reach the young people of that area at that particular time. And God met them when they stopped panicking and got down to prayer. And we've had to learn this here over St. Peter's, over evangelism in the parish, over provision of staff, over the club rebuilding, over the club mission, and now over the appointment of a new rector. Do you believe God is in it or not? If you believe God is able to meet this new situation for all souls, then you'll pray. And you'll come at this new situation believing God can and will show his provision in his own way, in his own time, and we shall give him the glory. Now, we may have to apply this in our own lives over our new job or a new domestic situation or seeking a house or something of that kind. But is the God who saved you the God who can also meet you in this moment of personal need? Of course he is, if you believe he is. He's well able. And so in verse 27 of this chapter 15, they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees. They had no need to panic. God's total provision, more than they could have expected, was just around the corner, if wildernesses have corners, but it was just there anyhow. And so that's going to be true in every situation in which God is involved, if we look to him. So we have to learn to trust and obey the Lord in every situation. Then, secondly, we need to learn to trust and obey the Lord in every situation. Let's put the underlining there, the Lord in every situation. Look at chapter 16. They set out from Elim, from that wonderful provision. And all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin between Elim and Sinai. And verse 2, and the whole congregation of the people of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness, this time because they were hungry. You'd have thought they'd have learnt it in chapter 15. Oh, no. Now they murmur again. This is part of the price of leadership. They murmured against Moses and Aaron in verse 2. But Moses and Aaron make it quite clear in verse 7 and 8 of chapter 16 that what was in fact happening was that the people of God were murmuring against God and not just the leadership. So verse 7 speaks about hearing the murmurings against the Lord. And verse 8 speaks about the Lord has heard your murmurings, which you murmured against him. What are we? Your murmurings are not against us, but against the Lord. Now this is a very real warning, not least in the midst of Christian work. When we complain about something that is going on in the church, are we really murmuring against the leadership or against the Lord? I had a very nasty letter this week. You know, I get them occasionally. And this was a nasty letter from somebody in Tunbridge Wells, who last came to this church in 1955 and wrote a letter saying what a dreadful thing had been done to All Souls, turning it into a place of dancing and entertainment instead of a house of prayer, etc., etc., and said, shame on all those involved in this terrible act. Of course, the answer is that the Lord led us into it. And that statement from this rather obnoxious person in Tunbridge Wells is saying something against the living God who led us into it. And we don't say that glibly or idly, do we, as a church? We didn't go into it except waiting upon God for the way in which he was leading. Beware of uttering your complaint when actually you're uttering against God. And it's very easy to look at human leaders and ministers and to blame and criticize them. So what God does at this point is not just to meet their need of food, to meet their hunger, but to meet it in such a way that it encourages their trust in him as Lord. Verse 4 of chapter 16. They were to have bread from heaven, a day's portion every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or not. Verse 5, they were to have twice as much on the sixth day, so that they didn't have to collect it on the Sabbath. Verse 6, at evening you shall know that it was the Lord, that's it, you see, that know it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. In the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord. And what is happening in the way in which God handles the situation is to point them back to himself as the Lord. Verse 9, say to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, come near before the Lord. Verse 12, then you shall know that I am the Lord your God. So God's decision to feed the nation in this particular way with the quails and the manna was not just to meet their hunger, but to help them to see him for who he really is. And so often this is the way God works, that his glory and power are shown in the way he answers, in the impossibility of the situation, here in providing flesh and bread in the wilderness and feeding that vast multitude. Or here in All Souls, in some of the ways which many of us who've been here a number of years can look back, in his remarkable timing and his particular touch in answer to prayer, in his overwhelming love, sometimes at the very last minute, actually the last day over the sale of the old Waldegrave Hall. How God held us, not just because he didn't want to provide the answer, but to help us to see him as the Lord. And now, in All Souls, we face a changeover. Can we trust him as Lord in this situation? Perhaps the very way he answers will again teach us to trust him as the Lord, in the timing perhaps, or in the way in which he decides to work it through for us as a church family. And all of us, perhaps, as we face new situations in our life, Myrtle and myself as we go to Chester, how are we going to find what we want, in a sense, the local, real prayer support that isn't a clique and isn't a sort of favoritism group? I don't know, but I believe the Lord will meet what we know to be a need in our lives. Together, we must trust him as the Lord. Thirdly, in this passage, we learn to trust. Now put the underlining under trust. To trust and obey the Lord in every situation. Chapter 16, verse 13. In the evening, quails came up and covered the camp. And in the morning, there was dew, and on the dew, face of the wilderness, a fine flake-like thing, fine as hoarfrost on the ground. And people said, "What is it?" And that is the word manhu, which has become, it is manna, the manna in the wilderness. And verse 15 speaks about what the Lord has given you to eat. And verse 16 is the invitation. Gather of it, every man of you, as much as he can eat. You shall take an omer apiece according to the number of the persons whom each of you has in his tent. And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. And when they measured it with an omer, he that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack. Each gathered according to what he could eat. This is the loving provision of God. It was sufficient, not more, not less, but sufficient. But this was to be a daily provision, except on the Sabbath. Thus, the people of God were again put in a dependence on God's provision every day. But human nature doesn't like it. Most of us would prefer to have security in material terms. Verse 19 has the command, "Let no man leave any of it till the morning." But verse 20 says, "They didn't listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning. It bred worms and became foul. And Moses was angry with them." Now, not angry with a sort of petulance that they hadn't done what he said, but angry because the reason, obviously, people had kept it till the next day, or tried to, was in case God didn't provide it the next day. Isn't it? And thus they were going against the trust that God could provide every day, day after day after day after day after day, for month and month and month and years. They had to trust God in this way. And I want to say that I think that this is something which some Christians have to come to terms with. Occasionally, I read in recent days of appeals, not just for the provision of a particular need in rebuilding or in meeting the need of a staff member, but of building up a capital sum so that this could be secured for the years to come. Personally, I find it very difficult and don't give to those sort of projects because I think they're asking for a security. When God provides the sum like that, out of his own way and his own provision, so be it. But for us to say, well, now if we could build up this big capital sum and then we can live on it, oh no. I don't think that's God's way, except in exceptional circumstances, and he makes it clear when it is like that. But our God expects us to trust him day by day, verse 21, morning by morning. Jesus himself said to us, didn't he, in the Sermon on the Mount, "Do not be anxious about your life. Do not be anxious about tomorrow." And thus it has been one of the lessons running right the way through the scriptures, right the way through to the present day, for every one of us to understand that it is morning by morning that I see his mercies and his love. And that his faithfulness is a day-by-day faithfulness. Of course all of us would like it wrapped up. Some of you young people would love to have God come and tell you exactly what's going to happen over the next 50 years. But would you really want to know? And I would like to know how my new job's going to work out. Because in part of me is scared stiff of it. And yet I know that it is the same Lord who will be there in Chester. It is the same Lord who will be with you in your life, in whatever lies before you. And that morning by morning we shall prove the Lord's provision if we go on trusting him. Fourthly, let's put the word, the underlining under obey. We learn to trust and obey the Lord in every situation. Now, the lessons being learnt by Israel, or at least I should say being taught to Israel, because they were rather slow to learn them, have a wider application. Go back for a moment to chapter 15, verse 26. 15:26. The Lord's action for them is intended to open them out to a complete obedience and response, not just to this particular incident of the provision of the water or of the food. They are to see him as Lord and to submit to him as Lord. If you will diligently hearken to the voice of the Lord your God and do that which is right in his eyes and give heed to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases upon you which I put upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord your healer. So there is obedience with promise. Obedience to the Lord's will and his commandments. We cheapen the Christian faith into which we've been called by Jesus if all we want is God's help towards us, but are not prepared to submit ourselves to him as Lord. Many people, I think, remain in this strange dichotomy of the Christian faith. They want salvation and all its benefits, but they have no intention of putting their lives at the feet of God and submitting to his word and his laws and his commandments and his will and his purpose and his direction for their lives. And they cheapen the very salvation that they have received. And the lesson that Israel had to learn here is a lesson for all of us to understand that if we want the provision of the Lord, it also is something which goes with our obedience to the Lord and his will and way for our lives. Chapter 16 and verse 26, if you'd look on to that, introduces the idea of the Sabbath. Although this is implied in Genesis 2, this is the first actual reference in the Bible to the Sabbath. And this was a particular commandment of God. And over this, there was a sort of test case of obedience for the people of God. On the sixth day, they were given double the amount. How did God do that and it didn't go off the next day? Presumably by a temperature change. God is well able to control the weather. But on chapter 16, verse 27, some went out on the Sabbath day to see if they could get more. And verse 28 comes the rebuke. How long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? And so here, and across verses 29 and 30, there's this whole example of a matter of obedience. And I want to ask you if there are areas in your life, as I must ask myself of my life, where, if we are honest and frank with ourselves, we are deliberately disobeying God. Yes, we have his salvation. Yes, we may be serving him in the church in one way or another. But there is one area where God is banned. We are not going to let him in there. That is going to be something where we're not going to listen to his word, where we'll twist his word to suit us if necessary. And I want to say to you, you can't do that with the living God. That if you belong to him and have received his provision of salvation and all his blessings day by day, the whole of your life must be open to seek his will, his commandments, and his word. Finally, as we finish, Fifthly, put the underlining under learning to trust and obey the Lord in every situation. The learning process goes on through life, and we learn more and more of his way and will, I think, as we go on in the exciting journey of being a Christian. In fact, isn't it marvelous to be a Christian? Very often the non-Christian finds the world dripping through his fingers. His ambitions begin to fade, the various things begin to go, physical health begins to go. Yet a Christian has so much to look forward to in this life and eternity. And I think it's marvelous to be a Christian with all the new vistas and challenges, always more to learn and see about our God and the way in which he works. Thank him constantly for that. And so the learning process is intended to go on. And in verse 32, this learning process is something we need to give to other people. Verse 32, let an omer of manna be kept throughout all generations. And verse 34 says this is to be a testimony, so that the generations coming behind them could say, look, this is how our God provided for us in the midst of the impossibility of the wilderness. And it's good for all of us who've seen God at work to testify, particularly to younger Christians, to show them that God is well able to bring his people through the most impossible situation. We don't have to have a sort of glass case with it in here. We're in it. And we can go and touch the brickwork down below and say, this is what God did in the miracle of the rebuilding here. We had the foreign correspondents, or quite a large number of them, from the foreign press here the other day. And it was marvelous to have them down in the hall and tell them what God had done. Many of them want to come back and do further interviews now. Well, there's a member of the church family here who, when he was in the army in Northern Ireland, had coins in the top pocket instead of in his pocket down here in his trousers. And he will show you the coin where the bullet stopped, going through the first coin into the second, and why he's alive and witnessing for Christ today. And he can show you the coin as a testimony to what God has done in his provision. Be free to testify to what God does for us, individually and corporately. We are to share it to encourage others. And when we began the new building project in the clubhouse a little while ago, it did my heart the world of good to hear somebody say, oh, I'm so glad we're having another building project. I missed the last one. Instead of saying, oh no, we've got to raise more money, here was excitement that God was going to do again. Hallelujah. That each succeeding generation can lay hold of God in that way. And yet how dull can we be? For as we finish in chapter 17, you just glance your eye across it, what happened? They came to Rephidim, there was no water. Not again, no water. Well, they sorted it out this time, haven't they? They've learnt the lesson. Oh no, they murmured. What, not again? Yes, they murmured yet again. This is the people of God, mentioned in Psalm 95 and verse 8. Harden not your hearts as at Meribah. Look at verse 7. As at Meribah, as on the day at Massah in the wilderness, when your fathers tested me and put me to the proof, though they had seen my work. What a tragedy. A tragedy that brought judgment on the people of God. And I want to cry to any in this church family who still will not acknowledge the miracle of God amongst us over these years, and who somehow have never been able to see it, and have stood still in their Christian life, and just don't have the liberation of praising God for what he's done. So may the Lord deliver us as we face the future, our personal futures, and our future at All Souls. May we learn to trust and obey the Lord in every situation. May we learn to trust and obey the Lord in every situation. May we learn to trust and obey the Lord in every situation. May we go on learning to trust and obey the Lord in every situation. The question at the end of chapter 17, verse 7 is the Lord among us or not? I hope every Christian heart may say, yes, the Lord is among us, able to provide, and will do so, because he is the Lord.